Welcome to the Flow Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It's 3:04 p.m. That is Central Time. Today is Friday, so it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. And I thought I would kick off this week by looking at the total number of bonds that have traded at a negative yield, because we've had a really profound contraction in that number over the course of just 1 week. And that's because a lot of bonds in Europe have moved from negative into positive territory in a short period of time. We've had a significant breakout on the Bund yield, for example. But 4 trillion moving from negative into positive territory, it's a big deal. And many people have been wondering at the illogical way that people could possibly have justified paying such high prices for negative yielding assets where there was a guaranteed loss of capital baked into the price, and yet people were lining up to buy these bonds. And that persisted for such a long time that it was considered normal. And we can see that now the rate is down to about 6 trillion, which is still a lot of money. But of course, in today's world, 6 trillion and the trillion dollar number seems to be thrown around with abandon. But we are back at the lows that were last seen in 2018, and that was the last time yields started to move higher. So it's certainly begging the question, how much higher are yields going to go, and what kind of effect is that going to have on just about everything? So 10-year Treasury yields were up today 8 basis points, and that's not an insignificant move. And we're also now back above the 1,000-day moving average. Now, when we look at the 10-year U.S. Treasury yield, that's not particularly strange. There have been occasions in the past when it has pushed back above the 1,000-day moving average. And we are closing in on the psychological 2% level. But more important than that, we are now above the 1.5% level. And 1.5% was the lower side of the overhead trading range. We're now well inside that barrier. The upper side of that range was around 3%. And if we cast our minds back to the end of 2018, that was when people started to really talk about debt sustainability. They started wondering about the potential for the end of this epic bull market. And of course, subsequently, we've had this incredible contraction in yields, where they went from 3.25 to 50 basis points in the space of 18 months. And now they're starting to march back upwards again. But of course, the total amount of debt outstanding has increased by at least 25% in just the last 18 months. So now we have a situation where there's a lot more debt and interest rates are rising. And obviously that's going to put pressure on governments, because every couple of basis points that the cost of borrowing increases, well, then it means that money isn't going to get spent somewhere else. So when we then think about what that's going to do to growth and the ability of economies to continue to prosper, well, there's either going to have to be cuts in spending, there's going to have to be less in the way of social benefits, or then there's going to have to be higher taxes. So these are significant factors. Not only do we have higher yields and we have higher inflation right now, although I think it is arguable whether inflation has in fact peaked. It's, I think, quite likely that inflation is peaking as we speak, because when we have yields rising, well, then that's increasing the cost, for example, of houses. Now, obviously, at the beginning of an interest rate cycle, people rush to lock in lower yields, and then that helps to inflate asset prices further. But the higher the price goes, well, then the greater the willingness of people will be to just wait it out. Ultimately, they won't have much of a choice. I mean, I know lots of people who are older than I am who bought their first houses with interest rates well into the double digits. And that was fine because they were able to get fixed rate mortgages for the majority. My parents were able to buy their first home with a fixed rate mortgage, and then the interest rate went up so much, inflation went up so much, that their repayment actually contracted in real terms. So that was a really important factor. The vast majority of mortgages today are floating rate, and that's particularly true in the countries where property prices are highest relative to income in places like Canada, Australia, and the UK. So these higher rates that we're seeing emerging, and it's certainly true also in Canada that bond yields are moving higher, and most people don't have a fix beyond a couple of years, and we're up to 1.85% now, and that is not all that far away from the peaks that we saw in 2018, but it's taking us back to the peak levels we saw in 2015, and the quantity of debt outstanding has increased substantially since then. The UK is among the countries most active in raising interest rates, and the Bank of England did it again in here this week, so that's two interest rate hikes now, and there is increasing speculation they might even go for 50 basis points in about a month's time. So the 10-year yield is marching higher. There's a very clear succession of higher reaction lows over the course of the last 18 months, and it's continuing to push upwards from here. But in this occasion, there have been occasions in the past when the yield has moved above the 1,000-day moving average, but there's only really been one when the 200-day moving average was above it. And now we're starting to see that occur in the UK as well. So in the last 2 weeks, the 10-year yield pushing higher has dragged up the 200-day moving average. So if the UK is among the most aggressive in raising interest rates, Australia is among the least aggressive, and they're continuing to be reluctant to raise interest rates, and yet the yield was also up in here today. So we're seeing rising yields everywhere, and some countries are attempting to curtail that risk, and then others are wondering about how they can possibly curtail inflationary pressures. One thing I thought was interesting today was the move that we saw on Boral in Australia. And the share was down hugely, but it was because of a massive special dividend they're about to pay. They sold their US building materials business, and they're returning pretty much the entirety of the windfall to investors. So this big decline is pricing in that massive dividend. But they're selling building products, and you've got rising interest rates in Australia. There's a real chance that they might rue the day that they gave away all that money and didn't hold on to it to preserve their domestic business. And when we think about what is going on in Australia, well, the big weightings in the stock market remain banks. So that's certainly helping to fuel the recovery here. And the banking sector is continuing to bounce, and the ASX 200 is also up on consecutive days and finding support in the region of the upper side of what really is a very lengthy ranging phase. The peak back in 2007 was only surmounted for a brief period ahead of the pandemic, and it's been consolidating around that area now for the last few months. If interest rates are going to push higher and inflation is going to be stickier, I think it's solid argument that inflationary pressures are probably peaking now. But it's not so much about the peak, it's about where the trough will be when inflation does start to come back down. And it's likely to be quite a bit higher than it was ahead of the pandemic. So that's, I think, an important factor. Now, if interest rates risks are rising, well, there's short, medium, and long-term considerations that need to be taken into account. The first is that the 10-year, the total return on 10-year futures has been one of the most consistent trends in the world. There's only been one occasion when it came down to test the 1,000-day moving average, and then it bounced really emphatically in 2018. So back then, that was when people were worried about the end of the bull market, and there was good reason for that. The total return had been trending lower for most of the previous 2 years. But we're in a similar situation now, where the rate or the total return peaked in August of 2020, and it continues to deteriorate. And higher yields from here are going to put additional downward pressure on the total return outlook for treasuries. So this is problematic. Central banks are talking about raising rates, and they're worried about inflation. And oil prices are marching higher. And oil was up another $2 in here today. And that's on the back of OPEC being parsimonious with their willingness to increase supply. Then you have the major producers where they're being curtailed from spending on additional new supply. Now, whether they want to or not, you have I think was it in the three board seats on ExxonMobil were taken over by the Green Movement. So they're not going to be spending a lot of money on speculative activity. So that's helping to support oil as well. And prices are pushing back up towards this $100 area. And this is a really impressive breakout from what was effectively a 7-year range. So there's clear scope that we're going to see oil prices pushing back up towards the upper side of this range. But spikes in energy prices contribute to demand destruction. And if we're going to see significantly higher oil prices, well, we're definitely then also going to have to see a lot more stimulus. We're going to have to see a lot more economic activity to justify that or to overcome the taxing effect of significantly higher energy prices. And gasoline futures are also still marching higher. So when we think about electric vehicles, well, obviously that's one of the factors that would mitigate demand on gasoline. And the gasoline price is well up into the range that persisted between 2011 and 14, and it's a really impressive breakout. So there's plenty of trading underneath it, and this has legs. It could quite easily push on to test the peak from back in 2008. So we have to at least price in the potential that growth is going to slow down, and that these are going to have knock-on effects. What I found really interesting this week was when we think about Amazon, it was reasonably easy to predict that its cloud business was going to surprise on the upside because we'd seen the same sort of thing from both Google and Microsoft, and there was no reason to think that Amazon Web Services wasn't going to do the same. But Amazon is still a low-margin business, and the majority of their profit in this quarter came from Rivian. Now, the share broke lower last week, and it rebounded $375 in here today. So that's impressive. But guidance is obviously not going to isn't as ambitious as the size of this rebound would imply. And then the question, of course, is what's going to happen at the end of this quarter? Because Rivian's share price is down from around $100 to $60. So this isn't a surging valuation. And the reflection that we saw in the income statement was from the end of last year. So back then prices were 100 and now they're 60. That's going to be a significant write down. So there's the real potential that at the end of the first quarter, Amazon could be looking at a loss. And then we can think about the same kind of thinking for companies like Google and Microsoft. Well, their cloud businesses continue to do well, but are they going to continue to grow at the same pace as 2021? We're certainly seeing more companies looking at automation. So, and then there's a lot of people don't want to come back to the office. So that's obviously one of the big growth themes behind cloud. And we've seen a really significant drawdown in the broad cloud sector. And we're short-term oversold. So there's certainly potential here that we're going to see a rebound in some of these sectors. And we've seen upward dynamics in here today. So that's suggesting that we could have a reversion back up towards the mean. And Datadog, another one of these cloud companies, or I guess basically managing cloud infrastructure and rack space, was able to also return a positive move in here today. So it looks like a higher reaction low. And we're seeing more of these companies bouncing from the region of the 200-day moving average. So this is positive action. And it's suggesting that we have certainly got scope for reversionary moves, that they're not going to decline in a straight line. And we're also definitely seeing that investors are willing to bet that inflationary pressures aren't going to derail growth, and that the economy is firing, the US economy in particular is firing on all cylinders. So with almost maximum employment, that it's about time that some interest rate hikes took place. And then there's good data to suggest that the first couple of interest rate hikes don't really have much of an effect on risk-taking behavior. And the 10-year treasury, or the, excuse me, the yield curve spread, the 10-year minus the 2-year, is down to 60 basis points. So we've had a big contraction this week. Last Wednesday, we had Jay Powell talking about, I was asked about the yield curve spread, and he says, well, you know, it's around 75 basis points, that's not a big deal. In less than a week, we saw it come down to 60. And this is clearly a trend. So it's quite likely that at some point this year, potentially towards the end of this year, we're going to see an inverted yield curve. And then that will start the clock on the next recession. And I think it's important to highlight that because there's the possibility that if inflation is a real factor, well, then data would suggest that if inflation does remain higher, then expansions tend to be shorter on average. So if we think that this expansion started again in April of 2020, well, then we're almost 2 years into this expansion. And it's unlikely that this expansion is going to last up into the 120-month or 128-month periods like we saw from the last expansion. So the inconsistency that has crept into the market right now, well, this is problematic. We can think about the NASDAQ 100, and it was beautifully consistent all the way up until about 4 weeks ago, and then it pulled back into the underlying trading range, broke the sequence of higher reaction lows, and now is in the region of the 200-day moving average. Well, we had an advance of nearly 200 points in here today, but it's still below the 200-day moving average. And it's going to have to push back above it in order to really confirm that we're back in a demand-dominated environment. And the most important thing right now is that we've had the earnings from the vast majority of the mega cap companies. So the potential for big moves in the market is just from single stock volatility is in fact contracting. So we had the very large dip yesterday on Facebook's earnings, and then a pop on the upside in here today on the back of Amazon's earnings. The next one that's going to give us some color is Nvidia. And Nvidia won't be reporting until the 16th, so 2 weeks from today. And the share is steadying in the region of the 200-day moving average. We've had a pretty substantial pullback already. So now the big question is, how much further is this rally going to go? We might see some additional steadying here because people are willing to give the benefit of the doubt to earnings growth persisting indefinitely. But I just don't believe it. I think that it's unlikely that cloud growth is going to persist in the same fashion in 2022 as it did in 2021, regardless of what the of how well these stocks have bounced. And then when we think about the performance of these extraordinarily large companies relative to the wider market. So we've had a lot of volatility in this measure over the course of this week. It surged higher for a few days and then pulled back extremely violently yesterday. So we're finishing out the week below the 200-day moving average. And when we then just simply look at this on a weekly basis, well, we've had a meaningful contraction, and it's a failed break. That's, I think, the most important factor here, that it pushed on to new high ground in November, December, and since then it's been coming back down. So when we think about what this means, well, these were the companies that did best, going from a position of about 5% of the total market cap of the market to 23% in the space of 8 years is a phenomenal advance. And now we're starting to see it deteriorating. So this is a warning shot that this profound bull market in the new tech sector, or I think perhaps more correctly, it's the majority of these companies were the ones that benefited most from the introduction of 4G. And it was wireless technology and access to high-speed broadband internet via someone's phone was something that helped to propel the outlook for Apple, for sure, then for Nvidia in terms of graphics chips. When we think about Amazon, well, the online shopping, and most particularly people shopping from their phones, is one of their big factors. Facebook and social media and Instagram and TikTok all benefited from 4G. So we've been pricing in the benefits from 4G technology for most of the last decade. Now the big question is, what happens with 5G? And this is going to represent a completely different subset of beneficiaries. Now, we definitely have a lot of interest in the metaverse right now. It's the buzzword in the tech sector. And in order for it to become more than a buzzword, we're going to need a significant innovation in headsets. So they're going to have to get smaller, lighter, more efficient, better resolution. And then also, they're going to have to be easier to get on and off. And there's going to have to be a massive input improvement in the shopping experience, in the meeting experience that we have in the metaverse. So it's still very much in its infancy. Well, Facebook has made a clear bet that it's the future of the company, and it sold off aggressively this week, and it's now in the region of the 1,000-day moving average. If the trend is going to be consistent, we're at the low, and it should bounce from here. If it fails to bounce from here, well, then we have completely broken the secular trend, and we're in a new environment where they will have to prove to investors that the metaverse can be profitable. And obviously, people are not convinced of that just yet. Now, Microsoft is going a different way. So they've bought Activision Blizzard. So what they've done now is they've boosted the assets that they have in their gaming sector, like the Xbox. They're also aware, of course, that the vast majority of virtual reality applications are very much tied to the gaming sector and the whole monetization model, selling skins, selling downloadable additional content. These were all pioneered by the gaming sector and buying virtual assets like NFTs, but just buying in-game items has been a feature of the gaming sector for years already. And now there's an effort to drive that into the broader economy. It's, of course, an additional question whether Microsoft will in fact be able to buy Activision. But the share at least is still holding the region of the 200-day moving average. And then we can think about Google, where it popped on the upside on very strong cloud revenues and then pulled back over the last few days. So it got all the way up to 3,000, and there's the possibility here that institutional investors are waiting until they split the stock before they buy even more. They might like to have the retail tailwind behind them to supplement the potential for additional upside. And of course, this gimmick of reducing the share price and stock splits, well, stock splits were extremely popular in the 1990s. And I remember Cisco going through multiple stock splits. And then Tesla went through stock splits over the last couple of years, and so did Apple. And both those occasions, it helped to support their prices. So that's obviously what Google is attempting to do now as well. And Tesla is bouncing now from the region of the 200-day moving average. And at least there is some rationale for that, because with higher oil prices, the rationale for buying an electric vehicle becomes more compelling. But the higher oil prices go, well, then it's also going to begin to create an argument about the viability of the market. Because we're seeing automotive companies building factories left and right, and they're going to be producing a lot more electric vehicles over the course of the next few years. And in Europe in particular, natural gas prices are still holding very high levels, and they're continuing to support the carbon emissions price as well. And that is trending higher, and it is closing in on the 100 level. So this is, I think, going to represent an investment opportunity that could supplant some of the reliance on bonds, because you get some of the bond-like characteristics. These are government-sponsored entities. And in the event that the price starts to come back down, well, then governments will move in and remove some of the supply and ensure that prices stay high. So you get the bond-like guarantee and the equity-like returns. And when bond yields are rising and anyone who's bought a German bond over the course of the last 5 years is now sitting on a loss. So what are they going to do? If they're holding 10-year yields, well, or 10-year bonds, they'd be much better off selling them and buying floaters. Or they'd be much better off shortening up the duration, because your shorter dated bonds aren't going to be as interest rate sensitive as longer dated bonds. So this is a meaningful breakout on the German yield. We're definitely starting to see more worry about rising interest rates and inflation. But as I've said before, I think that it's going to be extremely difficult for governments to reduce their spending, and it's going to be even more difficult for central banks to raise rates because of the risk that we're going to have a meaningful economic contraction or deflationary forces unleashed as a result of these actions. And the interest rate sensitivity of the market is much higher now than it was 3 or 4 years ago. So this is going to weigh on the stock market. But then, of course, we have this, I think it's an interesting phenomenon. So if we look at the, I'm really at a loss as to why this doesn't work for me. So I'm gonna have to pull it up a different way. But the ratio of the S&P to oil is, I think, rather interesting right now. So when we look at this index on a log scale chart, and I'm using the oil history metric, what I find most interesting, and it's really useful because we can go back 100 years. So one thing is very clear. We have a succession of higher highs. What that means is that during bear markets for oil, oil has done successively worse against the stock market. Now, that also reflects the less energy intensive nature of the stock market. So when you're talking about companies that don't have a lot of industrial capacity, well, then they're not as influenced by the oil price as they would have been in past cycles. And that has been true on successive occasions over the course of the last century. But and then we can also think about the lows. So the lows aren't really consistent at all. We had a really big low in 1980. We had an important low in 74 as well. And then we've had other lows, particularly in 2008, or ahead of the crash in 2008, to be more correct. So we've definitely seen a new peak. And if this trend persists, then oil prices will do substantially better than the S&P 500, and potentially on a secular basis. So we could be looking at a downtrend that could last for anything from a decade to more than a decade. And we're still towards the upper side of the range. So there's the potential that with oil pushing back up towards 100, that it might move even further higher from there. And I think we have statistics from the 1980s, and the oil sector was about a third of the market, and today it's only about 3% of the market. So it's fallen in relative importance by 90% over the course of about 40 years. And that would also suggest that it could do substantially better. One thing that I find, so I think that's sort of sitting out there on the horizon. Now, one other point I think is relevant is this ratio peaked in 2020. So it was about a year and a half ago. The last peak as well was in 1998. Well, the stock market didn't really peak until the beginning of 2000. So the relative peak of the stocks versus oil occurred well in advance of the peak in the stock market. And of course, we also know that interest rates were rising into the beginning of the year 2000 as well. So we haven't had interest rates rising yet. We're only starting to see bond yields responding to the threat of rising interest rates right now, although some countries like the UK have already risen rates twice. And then let's think about how this starts to reflect gold. So the Dow gold ratio has had a meaningful contraction, or I guess a correction. I looked at this regularly for years, and what I found most especially compelling about the long-term cyclicality was how reliable it was. And then we would have normally assumed that we'd have a secular bull market, and that the secular bull market wouldn't peak until sometime in the mid-2030s, because it was about 35 years between the peaks, and the last major peak was in 2000. So I thought it was going to be a secular bull market as long as this ratio was trending higher. And then we had this really meaningful contraction. And then we had a significant advance again. So the big question now is, are we going to see this ratio contract? Because the most ardent bulls of gold are looking at this phenomenon in the mid-1970s, where we had a profound contraction. And then basically a two-year period where stocks did much better than gold. And then a four-year period where gold did way better than stocks. Well, on this occasion, it's been a decade, because the low in the ratio was in 2011. And the peak was between 2018 and 19. So if this is a peak, well, then it would suggest that the first thing is that the cyclicality of the Dow gold ratio has been completely broken, and that this expectation that we would have 35 years between bubble peaks is in fact over. So now the question is, what's going to happen next? Are we going to see the Dow underperform gold, and will gold break out of this long-term range? Because one or the other is going to happen pretty soon. Gold prices have been going nowhere for most of the last 6 or 7 months, and the amplitude of the range has been contracting. So we had a big amplitude, a trough to peak swing back in the middle of 2021. Then we had smaller ones. Now we're having even smaller ones again. The price is now around the $1,807 area. Every time it has got up to $1,850, it's failed. And it did it again last week. So now the big question is it going to push higher from here? We still have this sequence of higher reaction lows. So that's helping to confirm that we're still in a demand-dominated environment. And I think this is pregnant with potential, because if gold pops on the upside, well, the one thing it's going to clearly signal is that investors believe that central banks are going to be inhibited from doing what's necessary to encourage additional interest rates, and I guess they're going to be inhibited from doing what's necessary to stop inflation from becoming trendy. And I think that that has to be the base case. There's just no way that the Federal Reserve is going to be able to raise rates by a couple of 100 basis points in the next 18 months without causing a recession. And if that's the case, well, then they're going to have to slow things down, or they're going to have to start pumping money into the repo system, or they're going to have to do something else. And then when that happens, gold will explode on the upside. Now, I do think that we're due a bounce for some of these stocks that have sold off aggressively. We've seen really meaningful pullbacks in the IPO sector, and it's bouncing from the region of the 1,000-day moving average, so we might get an additional bounce. And I think that there's also this important chart which highlights the fact that the US Treasury has been rebuilding its cash balance and that that process is almost done. And that sucking of $600 billion out of circulation and into the Treasury's coffers, well, that was quantitative tightening, and it contributed to this very steep decline that we saw on interest rate sensitive sectors. So we're nearly there. It's probably going to get up to about $700 billion, so about another $100 billion, and then the Treasury will start spending money and taking money again. So even with higher interest rates, there have been additional factors that have contributed to the selling pressure. So we're certainly due some pause and consolidation following very steep declines. But if oil prices continue higher, and I think this is the most important point, we need a catalyst to unlock the quantity of money necessary to really start to change the outlook for a zero carbon environment. We had lots of governments talking about the need to do it at COP26 back in December, but there aren't many that are actually doing anything about it. One of the most active in doing anything at all and spending money is, in fact, Saudi Arabia, which is probably surprising to the majority of people. And the index there continues to recover, and it was at a new recovery high in here this week. And of course, it's also responding to the higher oil price. And they are looking at selling an additional $50 billion worth of Saudi Aramco and creating an additional listing for the share. And they'll be using the proceeds from that sale to further their ambitions of building out a domestic mining sector and downstream processing and manufacturing to supply the rest, excuse me, of the world with the materials that are required to go carbon friendly. But we probably need a catalyst. When we're looking at this with higher yields and the prospect of heavier borrowing costs, it's going to be difficult to get money together for speculative investments. So I think it's going to be interesting to see how people think about climate change. Because when people say that the weather is getting colder, well, a lot of people are experiencing that. There are certain parts of the USA, for example, where there have been record cold snaps. And then there are other areas where people are looking out the window and saying, well, golly, this is the hottest weather anyone who's alive has ever experienced. And this map tells us that both of those claims are true. So what we're looking at is greater climate volatility. And you can think about up in North Dakota, where where they have both record highs and record lows. And of course, that's a major oil producing area. And you'd have to think that this same trend proceeds up into Canada. And if that's the case, well, that's we're talking about major wheat and agricultural production areas. And there's going to have to be a catalyst to really ignite public opinion. And one thing that I think is relevant is that there are lots of commodity prices have been going sideways forever. And if we are in a more climate volatile environment, then these agricultural commodities are going to break on the upside. And we're going to have commodity price inflation that's profound. That we haven't seen commodity price inflation that's really aggressive since the 1970s. This is the Bloomberg Agriculture Subindex. So it didn't really do much of anything in the early 1970s. And then it broke out. And it went up almost every year for a decade. And of course, there were spikes along the way. And it didn't peak until 1980. Now, we've had plenty of moves on the upside, and I would have to guess that this is a futures index. So, in order for a futures index to trend, you need to have a continuous backwardation. And in order for a continuous backwardation to occur, you have to have a really significant climate event that contributes to less supply against a background of substantially more demand. And we're going to have 2 billion people looking to have their mouths filled and their bellies filled over the course of the next 20 years against a background where there's going to be more climate volatility, or at least the potential for it. And to build the energy infrastructure necessary is going to require industrial resources on a scale that's really never been seen before. We could be looking at a doubling in the demand for copper per annum. And the mines don't exist to produce that amount of copper. And lithium prices are marching higher. I think this is also particularly relevant. We have clear evidence of supply inelasticity. And supply inelasticity meeting rising demand creates commodity bull markets. Now, it's not like the world is short of lithium, but or indeed that there isn't additional copper resources around the world. But nobody wants a lithium mine in their backyard, and nobody wants a copper mine in their backyard. And governments aren't really happy to champion it either. And the mining sector hasn't done a great job of endearing themselves to local communities. Some companies have done a fantastic job of it, and they don't appear in the news, which is how they like it. Others haven't done a good job of it, and they do appear in the news, and it sours public opinion towards the sector entirely. I had lunch with someone who finally got a deal done in the Dominican Republic a number of years ago, and they enabled the Dominican Republic, after a long period of being unable to get foreign direct investment, they pushed through legislation through Congress, and they got Barrick in to build a mine and to clean up the really disastrous environmental impact that the last mine had had. And it was enormously successful. And there's the potential that the Dominican Republic is really on the cusp of becoming an investment-grade credit. Well, we don't have the CEO of Barrick on Bloomberg TV talking about the merits of that job, because the last thing they want is to attract attention. Miners are terrified of media attention. So we're in a very difficult situation where there's no real appetite to push through the kind of mining legislation that would enable the security for foreign investors to pump money into developing new resources. And that's likely to continue to push prices higher. And if we see agriculture prices breaking out, then that's going to really concentrate the minds of politicians, because you get regime change when you get higher commodity prices. And we've already had a lot of social unrest in the last 18 months. And of course, we have these outstanding questions about what's going to happen with China and what's going to happen with Russia. Xi Jinping is at the moment attempting to ensure that he becomes president for life. And at the same time, his ambition is curtailing the I guess curtailing the job prospects for a significant number of Communist Party cadres. So it's not like he's going to have it all his own way. And of course, then we have Russia. Now, obviously, on the one hand, Russia is worried about NATO putting missiles in Ukraine and having a NATO member having a border with Russia is obviously something they don't want either. But are they going to be really willing to push it to an open war? Well, the ruble suggests that that's not going to happen. And Russia is in a position where they have oil, they have gas, and they have lots of gold supporting the currency. And most of the devaluation in the currency happened 7 years ago, and it's beginning to firm now from the 80 level. And the stock market pulled back violently over the course of this worry about Ukraine, but it is firming now from the region of the 1,000-day moving average. And it's been trending higher, albeit in an extremely choppy manner, for most of the last 5 years. So there's certainly scope here that commodity-related markets are going to start attracting greater attention. But the one thing that I've been talking about for the last 6 months has been the catalyst required to create the push. Because valuations alone aren't enough of a pull for foreign investors to really get animated about emerging markets. They also need a push, and the dollar is the push factor. If we're going to have higher yields and we're going to have interest rates rising and an inability of governments to continue to tighten their belt and really attempt to pay down their debts, well, then they need a weaker currency. And the dollar was down in a dynamic manner in here this week. So it's hovering here in the region of the 1,000-day and the 200-day moving average. And there is the potential that it could break lower. But it hasn't done it yet. So we don't really have the catalyst yet. But certainly there is, I think, an increasingly compelling argument that emerging markets are going to do better. What I find also rather interesting is that the Indian rupee has only trended higher during times when oil prices are high. And that's generally coincided with a lot of interest in the market. So obviously, India is a major energy importer. And it's problematic for the economy when they have to spend a lot of money on importing oil. So the RBI's only defense against that is to let the currency or engineer the currency to appreciate so that it moderates the price of oil. And that certainly happened between 2002 and 2008, and the rupee appreciated by about 20%. So we're now in a similar situation because oil prices are moving higher again and the rupee is reasonably steady. The higher that oil prices go and the longer they stay there, then the greater the incentive there will be for the RBI to intervene and try and appreciate the currency. So when we also think about what's likely in China, well, China is probably going to try and devalue their currency. They don't really have an inflationary problem at present. And they do have a problem with their property prices. And the property sector represents about 30% of the economy. So if property prices continue lower, it's going to take a significant lump out of growth potential in China's economy. And the Asia dollar index has been hovering here in the region of the 200-day moving average for 6 months. But it is above the 1,000-day moving average. And as long as that remains the case, then there's the potential here that it's going to start trending higher. So Asian currencies doing better overall will encourage additional new investments. And India has got the better growth potential because of the demographic dividend, so it's more likely to continue to attract additional investor interest. And then the credit cycle in India is still in the early stages. So it turned last year after a 7-year process of contraction. And the other, I think, important point about India is that it tends to be counter-cyclical and does not follow the same cycle as the wider global economy. So that also holds out the potential that it can weather issues in the wider global economy better. And it does tend to have some safe haven characteristics because it's not in cycle with the rest of the world. So I think that's an additional point that will encourage investors to it as we have uncertainty about the direction of interest rates or the sustainability of interest rates and the ability of stock markets to hold out as rates rise. So we're in an interesting environment. There's the potential that we're now on the cusp of seeing the best performing shares of the last decade lose that position, and the undervalued commodity sector starting to appreciate. So we've already started to see oil prices breaking out, and then the energy sector has followed on the upside, and companies like Chevron were able to push on to new all-time highs in here this week. And Chevron was one of the companies that was able to sustain its dividend during the pandemic panic, and it's now pushing on to new all-time highs. Of course, if gold pops up and out of its range, well, then we can anticipate that gold shares are going to become a lot more fashionable. And the gold miners ETF is right at the lower side of this range and beginning to steady. And then there isn't an ETF for fertilizer companies any longer. You have to get some of the farm equipment companies in there as well. But Mosaic is breaking out of this base formation and it's completing a base formation that's been lasting for 7 years. And I think we've seen lots of companies and lots of cycles that have lasted 7 years during this broadcast. And Nutrien is also in a reasonably consistent uptrend. Well, Bayer was probably rueing the day that they bought Monsanto, and they're still paying for Roundup. But we might be coming to the end of paying for Roundup, and the share is firming within its base formation, and it's still at a fraction of where the peak values were back in 2015. So there's certainly lots of interest in real assets and in commodities more generally. And obviously, we've seen significant drawdowns in the more speculative portion of the market. And with the cash treasury balance close to topping out, then there's certainly scope for some additional steadying. But if oil prices remain firm and the consistency breakdown on Wall Street isn't very quickly repaired, well, then we could be looking at a really significant migration. And these significant breakouts that we're having in the bond markets, these are not small events. There are legions of people losing money in the supposedly risk-free portion of their portfolios right now. And if we look at, for example, risk parity, well, I think there is obviously the potential here that it's just not going to do well. And the risk parity index was closing out the week below its 200-day moving average for the first time since early 2020. So the VIX index had been really quite firm and then contracted for the last couple of weeks, but it looks like it's a higher reaction low. But then we have volatility in bonds, which has been elevated and is staying elevated. So there's a real risk here that we're going to have a problem with government bonds, and that 60-40 portfolios are going to have difficulty, and they're going to have to do some significant migration. And the risk isn't in high-yield bonds. Now, obviously, high yield is not immune to selling pressure, but these bonds are not falling faster than treasuries, and the spread is only just beginning to advance here. What in fact we're seeing is that there is potential that there is a concentration of risk in governments and in institutional portfolios. Now, there's trillions that have been set aside for big declines by private equity. But what that money gets spent on doesn't have to be technology. Private equity firms might also be looking at oil properties. They might be looking at mining properties. They might be looking at the kinds of solutions that might create efficiency of demand for commodities as oil prices rise. So there's a lot of money sitting on the sidelines and waiting for investment opportunities. And we're in a dodgy situation right now for equities. And at the best case scenario is that it's a medium-term correction similar to what we saw in 2018. We do not yet have a confirmation of the Powell put. The market's only been down about 10%. In 2018, it took 20% before the Federal Reserve abandoned its interest rate hiking policy and its quantitative tightening policy. And we're just not there yet. So this correction remains ongoing. And I think with that, I'll leave you for the weekend and wish all the best to all of you.